Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what is being described as a coup in Egypt by the Egyptian Supreme Court, who on the eve of the final round of the presidential elections have dissolved the recently elected parliament. Khaled El-Gindi, a visiting fellow for Middle East policy at the Brookings Institution, joins us. He was recently in Egypt observing the first round of the presidential elections, and we will discuss the explosive situation now developing as the remnants of the old regime brazenly try to turn back the clock. Then we will speak with a Syrian-American activist who is the spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees. Rafif Jujati joins us to discuss the extent of popular opposition to the Assad family as the regime desperately and ruthlessly tries to maintain its grip on power and how, in spite of deadly reprisals, more and more army soldiers are defecting to the Free Syrian Army. Then, following reports in the Washington Post that the U.S. is expanding a secret shadow war in Africa, we will examine the role of U.S. Special Forces in their hunt for the murderous warlord Joseph Kony and how the Rwandan government, an ally of the U.S., is destabilizing the east of the Congo. Maurice Carney, the Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, joins us along with Jacques Bahati, a policy analyst at the Africa Faith and Justice Network. Joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. He was recently in Egypt, where he was observing the first rounds of the Egyptian presidential elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you make of this what's being described as a coup by the Supreme Court in dissolving the parliament on the eve of a presidential election?
Well, it's something that's very troubling from the standpoint of a democratic standpoint, certainly, and even from a domestic stability standpoint. It's also very troubling because it adds kind of more uncertainty and more frustration. On the Egyptian street. So it is definitely a setback for Egyptians across the board.
So is it likely then to spark the kinds of protests we've seen going back to the original Tahrir Square? Because I believe that Mubarak is very close to death. And, of course, one of the candidates in the elections coming up over the weekend is his last prime minister and a former friend and Air Force general.
Right.
He's up against a Muslim Brotherhood candidate. There's a sense that what's really at the heart of this revolution is whether the revolutionaries will overcome what is referred to by the Arabic word, the remnants.
Yeah. Well, that's been the challenge all along. But the revolutionaries have been hampered by many things, including their own lack of organization, their own lack of leadership, their inability to work with others. They're quite a divided group, but that's true really across the board of the Egyptian political scene. The Muslim Brotherhood is probably equally, if not even, it's even harder for them to work with different groups. So one of the fundamental problems with this transition, at least from the standpoint of anti-regime forces, is that they've been extremely divided. And so it's one of the reasons why I think the timing of this of these latest developments suggests that the SCAF, the military rulers, are confident in the fact that we probably won't see the kinds of mass mobilization that we saw in Tahrir Square in January of last year. And that is because there is now so much water under the bridge. There's a lot of bad blood between these different groups on the ground and the various political forces. The Muslim Brotherhood has lost a tremendous amount of credibility, as have, frankly, other forces like the revolutionaries. So I think it's less likely that we'll see a mass mobilization like we saw 16 months ago. But obviously the situation can change. You know, we don't yet know what will happen with the presidential elections. We don't know what will happen on the economic front. There's a lot of troubling signs there as well. There's a security vacuum on the ground. There are a lot of very, very troubling trends that could push this in any number of directions. But the one thing that I think we can say with a fair amount of certainty is that we won't be seeing a stable democratic Egypt anytime soon.
So in this ruling that took place by the Supreme Court, along with it, its leader, who took it a lot further than people were expecting, in declaring last year's parliamentary vote unconstitutional, he also, in a separate ruling, decided that the former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik, who was running for president and was the last Prime Minister under the old Mubarak regime, he was instated and given a seal of approval by the court. So, given that these two rulings came down together, I fail to see how it could be, if the purpose of this is for the old guard to get their candidate Shafik elected by dissolving the parliament and really angering the Muslim Brotherhood, at the same time saying that this candidate that's essentially the ancient regime candidate who, under the political exclusion law passed by the parliament, the senior officials from the former President Hosni Mubarak regimes were banned from standing. So the court overturns that ruling. At the same time, don't you think it's likely to backfire? I mean, isn't it likely to make people want to vote for the Brotherhood?
It could backfire, certainly. And I think that's one of the things that the Muslim Brotherhood is counting on right now. There are a lot of voices calling on the Brotherhood to withdraw their candidate from the elections in a few days in protest. Because on the one hand, the Brotherhood is calling this a coup and saying that the elections are likely to be rigged. On the other hand, they're going full steam ahead with these elections. So they're, you know, thereby legitimizing them. So there's a double message coming out of the Brotherhood, and one of the demands by outside groups, revolutionary groups and liberals, is well, you know, you have to put your money where your mouth is. If this really is such a flawed and delegitimized process, then why are you lending it legitimacy? You need to withdraw from the race. And I think they're not willing to do that. And I think, you know, that is... It's a risky proposition, but they may feel that they're, you know, from the Brotherhood standpoint, there are the political forces on the ground and the revolutionary groups have turned against them. They're now in a confrontation with the military rulers, and things might get worse. They've lost their one foothold, which was the parliament. And things might get worse down the road. And so they probably see the presidency as the only chance that they have left to avoid, you know, something like a serious crackdown. So they're prepared, I suppose, to take that risk. But, you know, it's that kind of decision making that has been so troubling, really, for the rest of the political class in Egypt, in that the Brotherhood's priorities seem to be focused entirely on what is good for them as an organization, as opposed to what is the best way to achieve the goals of the revolution.
Again, I'm speaking with Khalid El-Gindi, a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he was recently in Egypt where he observed the first round of the Egyptian presidential elections, and we're discussing the ruling by the Egyptian Supreme Court that dissolved the parliament on the eve of the final round of presidential elections between a holdover from the Mubarak regime, Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik, Air Force General, who's running against Mr. Mursi, who's with the Muslim Brotherhood. There was a troubling development on Wednesday when the Justice Ministry announced that army personnel would have the right to detain civilians during the election. How do you interpret that?
Well, this is the old emergency law through the back door. Just a few weeks ago, Egyptians were celebrating the expiration of the emergency law, which had been in place for 3 decades. And it now looks clearly like that was a purely cosmetic move, and now they've just kind of brought it back through the back door. So this is standard procedure for the SCAF, for the military rulers of Egypt. They've been extremely heavy-handed with their political opponents and critics. They've tried thousands and thousands of young people before military tribunals. There's been, of course, the violent responses to protesters on the streets. Something like 100 protesters have been killed since Mubarak's departure by Egyptian security forces. And so a lot of their behavior is clearly anti-democratic. They have manipulated the political process at various stages. And so what we're seeing now really is, you know, it's hard to take any one development in isolation, because this is the culmination of 16 months of incompetence on the one hand, attempted manipulation of the political and legal process on the other, as well as bad decisions by all sides, including revolutionary groups and political parties. And so that's why we're at where we are today. The bulk of the responsibility lies with the SCAF as the managers of this transition, and who have consistently laid out a bad sequence and bad priorities and simply the wrong roadmap from the very beginning. But there's plenty of blame to go around. It's just that the lion's share of the blame goes with those who are running the show.
So, Khaled El-Gindi, the court ruled based upon in invalidating last year's parliamentary elections, because some of the seats were contested on a proportional basis and others on the first past the post, and that was the excuse, if you will. In the election, of course, the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Department party won 46% of the vote, and coming in second was the Salafist Al-Nur party that caught everybody by surprise. I spoke to a number of Egyptians during the time that you were there, they all said very emphatically that Al-Nur, and that basically what's been happening is that the Saudi Arabians have been pouring in tons and tons of money and essentially created the Salafists, and that was the big surprise. So when you say there's a backlash against the Brotherhood, is that backlash the realization amongst a lot of Egyptians, the extent to which the Saudi feudal regimes, if you will, are trying to influence this nascent democratic awakening in Egypt?
Well, I mean, I think definitely there's, because of Egypt's strategic position in the region and its close alliance of Mubarak with Saudi Arabia and other Arab Gulf states, clearly the Saudis had an interest in the outcome. They were very upset with the overthrow of Mubarak and with his trial afterwards. And they've not been shy about expressing their disapproval of the entire Egyptian revolution. And there are, of course, these reports about money coming in from the Gulf and elsewhere. I think it's we need to be clear on one thing. The Saudi relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood is very complex. It's not, there's a history of mistrust there. So I'm not sure that there is anything to show that there is money coming in directly from Saudi Arabia to the Brotherhood, but certainly the Salafis, there is a lot of at least anecdotal evidence to suggest that that's the case. But this gets to sort of a deeper problem with the way this transition has been managed, in that it is a process with no rules. It's a game without any rules. So there are no real campaign finance laws, for example, in Egypt. There's a spending limit, which, of course, several candidates exceeded without any ramifications. But there are no disclosure requirements like we have in most Western democracies that require, a party or a candidate to show where they get their funding and how it's spent. And really, this has been the pattern all throughout this process of a game with no rules, and then the rules that are there are sort of made up as they go along. And they're made up by the most powerful groups, the SCAF, occasionally with the assistance of the Brotherhood or other political groups. And it is what has really destabilized the situation, because you've gone, you were supposed to undertake a democratic transition that would strengthen governing institutions and elected institutions, and what do you have? You have a judiciary that used to be considered the pride and joy of Egypt, that was considered relatively independent, and it's now been compromised and its reputation destroyed. You have the first freely elected parliament dissolved. You have a president, a presidential election that pits two of the two most divisive and hated candidates in Egypt against one another.
But how did they get elected then?
With no rule. I mean, no, but powers of the president are not even clear.
Yeah, but I don't. That's a contradiction, Khalid al-Gindi. How did the two most despised and unpopular candidates get elected?
Oh, well, because you had you had the several candidates
splitting the vote
first round, and so you had the so-called revolutionary candidates, about three of them, who took a big chunk, more than 40% in the middle of the electorate. But it was, the pro-reform or pro-democracy vote, I would call it, was split among two or three candidates. The other half of the electorate went for the old guard, either the regime itself in the person of Ahmed Shafiq, or the Muslim Brotherhood, which is really, of course, it's been around for eight decades. It is part of the old power structure, in a sense. So the problem was the splitting of this, pro-change vote. But it was clear on the ground, the partisans of these two individuals, the majority of Egyptians don't want either of them. I think that is
right.
That is the point. But because of the electoral system, in order to, since no one candidate took 50% plus one, they had to do it by a runoff.
Sure. And now it's down to the lesser of the two evils, which we're not entirely unfamiliar with here in the United States.
Yeah, but here in the United States, you have a system that doesn't allow third parties really to flourish to begin with.
Exactly. So. Well, just in closing, Khalid al-Gindi, basically what we have now is you have no constitution, which is very strange that you're having elections before there's a constitution.
Right.
You have no parliament. And you have an election between two unpopular and somewhat discredited presidential candidates.
Yeah, and a compromised judicial branch.
That's a recipe for trouble.
It is a recipe for trouble, because there is not even one institution that people can claim confidence in or can cling to as at least a foothold towards a democratic future. I mean, it's definitely true that these events have set us back 16 months, if not more.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Khalid al-Gindi.
Oh, you're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Khalid al-Gindi, who's a visiting fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. He was recently in Egypt, where he was observing the first round of the Egyptian presidential election. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a Syrian-American activist.
Then they fight you. Then you win. I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Boy, I easy lit the hoof. and it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Han Yunus, the new moon shines bright.
حبك نار في فؤادي متى أراك يوما حرا يا وطني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rafif Jujati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committee, a Syrian-American activist in the Washington, D.C. area. Rafif helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Jujati.
Thank you for having me.
And I heard you a day or so ago on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman debating Patrick Seal. Of course, Patrick Seal for many decades has been essentially an asset of the Assad family, whether they pay him or whether he's what the KGB call a useful idiot is somewhat beside the point, because he's an apologist and a propagandist for the Assads for, as I say, for decades.
Well, that's absolutely right. And Patrick Seal's history with the Assad family goes back a long ways. Now, the problem is that today, to apologize for the Assad regime is really inexcusable. He's making indefensible arguments in the face of massacres and rampant violence.
Well, he's doing his job, but he's not alone. At the time when the uprising began, back in March of 2011, Vogue magazine carried a story that was completely sycophantic about the so-called First Lady, Bashar al-Assad's wife, the English-born wife, who was described in glowing terms about her fashion sense at the very time when Assad's goons were torturing and mutilating young boys for writing graffiti on the walls against the regime.
Absolutely. And the Assad family had paid a public relations firm to enhance their image abroad. And the bottom line is that Assad is an English-educated doctor, formerly, and his wife is British-born and quite the lovely woman. And what Vogue did was to paint a picture of a cosmopolitan young couple leading their country into reform, and never once mentioned the fact that boys as young as 13 were being tortured and mutilated. Absolutely.
They've obviously have, the regime has had a very effective public relations operation in the West, and Barbara Walters, she's a friend of the young woman who was Assad's press spokesperson, and she's the daughter of the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations, and that's how an interview with Bashar al-Assad was arranged for ABC News and Barbara Walters, who essentially gave a very softball interview. I take it those days are off. It's just the only people that seem to be defending Assad nowadays in the West are sort of, you know, diehard anti-colonial leftists who think that this somehow is a case of Western intervention against some heroic popular leader.
And they may believe that, but all they need to do is watch the news or read a couple of newspapers to know about the horrific bombardment of villages and towns. There are many villages in Syria that have been utterly destroyed by the regime's shelling. The people who continue to be Assad apologists are forgetting that Russia is shipping hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons with which the regime can kill civilians. They're also forgetting that this is a popular uprising that has lasted 15 months.
And by the way, in terms of support on the left for Assad, it doesn't make any sense, because the uprising began in Deraa, which is the poorest working class part of Syria. This is actually a very populist left-wing uprising. That's its roots.
It's an uprising that began when the poorest of the poor were demanding that Assad finally implement the reforms he'd been promising for 10 years. And rather than extend a hand and show some positive movement towards reform or any sort of economic assistance to these people, the Assad regime chose to detain young children and torture them. And then they chose to fire live ammunition at peaceful protests.
Now, apparently the UN monitors have entered the town of Haffa. There was a concern a few days ago that the regime was poised to do ethnic cleansing there. It is, of course, the town that holds one of Shia Islam's holiest sites, the tomb of the Prophet Muhammad's granddaughter. My understanding is that the worst has happened there, and it's the same of what happened just recently with Hula, that the regime comes in with the tanks, shells the place, then they send in the Shabiha, the so-called ghosts, which are these death squads organized by Assad's brother, and they do their dirty work, and then before the monitors come in, they clean up the evidence, or some of the evidence.
Right, so the typical pattern is that first they cut off all electricity and communications, then they surround the town and go in and basically bomb it until there's nobody left. Now, Hafe in Latakia had a population of 30,000, and the regime shelled the city for 8 consecutive days. During that time, we do know that members of the Free Syrian Army were trying to smuggle families out of the area and into Turkey, and they succeeded in taking several families, but we don't have an exact count. And now a town that was once populated by 30,000 people is basically deserted. So we don't know the exact number of dead there.
So there is a discussion, of course, now in the press and amongst so-called experts about whether or not we're in a civil war. I mean, it seems like a somewhat fatuous discussion, given, 15,000 dead at least. It's never seemed to me to be a classic civil war by existing definitions, because it's not one group of civilians against another group of civilians. It's a regime's army against its own population. So it seems like we need a better definition than civil war for this.
Absolutely. Had it been two equally equipped armies fighting openly, we might have called it a civil war. Had it been civilian populations fighting one another, we might define it as a civil war. But what you have is a regime that is punishing a popular uprising that seeks freedom and democracy and regime change. It's important to remember that the revolution in Syria began with peaceful protests. In fact, even today, we have peaceful protests all around the country. The Free Syrian Army emerged as a result of the regime's violence against its own population, and as soldiers began defecting from the army because they were refusing to shoot at unarmed civilians.
Well, apparently there's been an uptick in defections. CBS got a camera in with some UN monitors a couple of days ago, and they filmed groups of defectors with the Free Syrian Army. And apparently what happens now is that somehow through a sort of underground telegraph, when these towns are under siege and the army is on the outskirts, the word gets out to some of these units. And when they go out on patrol at night, they sort of melt into the night and defect. I'd be curious to know how this is done, and how pervasive is it, and what do you think the numbers are? And the army is completely controlled by the Alawite Officer Corps and by Maha, the brother of Bashar al-Assad. There's a repeating of history here, in as much as the massacres that took place under the father, Hafez al-Assad, were conducted by his brother, who lives in comfortable exile in London.
Yes, so it's difficult to describe the exact operations surrounding the defections. They have their own methods and their own means because, as many know, when soldiers are less secretive about their defections, they are immediately executed. Day after day, we get reports about soldiers who are killed as they're laying down arms or simply for refusing to fire. We also know that there are forward troops that are given orders to fire, and there are troops bringing up the rear whose sole job is to make sure that the forward soldiers shoot. So it's a very difficult situation for those defecting soldiers. And the act of defecting from the army is in itself, in some ways, a suicide mission. So the fact that there are well over 40,000 Free Syrian Army soldiers is amazing and speaks to the character of a people that does not want to fire on its own. With regard to Hafez, the father, this is the same scenario playing out, except it's on a much wider scale. Of course, this is nationwide. In Hama, Hafez al-Assad killed anywhere between 10,000 and 40,000 people, and we will actually never know exactly how many people were massacred, as the brother, Rifat's forces, completely razed the city. This is playing out again across the nation, and much like in 1982 in Hama, there has been a severe clampdown on the press, even on the UN observers and on any international monitoring.
But Rafif Jojani, whenever you see footage of the monitors mingling with the Syrian people, it's obvious that they are feeling for the first time free to express themselves, and there's a moment of protection. And then, in fact, there's some considerable panic as these monitors leave these areas. So again, it's anecdotal, but you get the impression that even though you've got 40,000 defectors fighting along with the Free Syrian Army, and the extent to which they're being helped is not very clear, and it certainly doesn't seem particularly adequate compared to the forces arrayed against them. But the general impression I get is that the most of the population want this over, and I would assume that the best way to get it over with is to get rid of the Assad. So give us a sense, if you know, about how pervasive the opposition is, because we keep being told that the Alawite elite and the Christians are absolutely firmly in Assad's camp, and the reason they stick with him, whether they like him or not, is that they fear they're going to be massacred if the Sunni majority take over.
Well, I completely disagree with that. First of all, the opposition is pervasive in that it is around the entire nation. We have large numbers of Christian and Alawi supporters. In fact, there are hundreds of Alawites detained for having expressed their support of the revolution. We have some very prominent Alawis and Christians who have come out and spoken in favor of the opposition. Look, Syrians understand that Assad used to pretend to provide stability in the nation. Well, he's clearly failed in that. He has continuously blamed this uprising on Islamic terrorists. Yet how did they get in there in the first place under such a stable and secure nation? This is a popular uprising. The people of Syria are not sectarian by nature. The Assad regime has done its best to sow sectarian divisions among communities. While it's true that his top military officers are Alawis, primarily Alawis, it's not true that all of the soldiers are. The soldiers in Syria are conscripts. And we have a great many hundreds who are now failing to report for duty or going absent without leave.
So what is your sense then of how this is going to continue and how it's going to unfold? If this is a popular uprising, and a lot of analysts have told me that Bashar al-Assad's not really in control. So let's deal with that question first. Do you have any evidence that that's not the case? And if it is the case, who is actually in control? Is it his brother, Maher, who runs the death squads, or is his mother, or is it some other group of intelligence and military officers?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation ever since the day Bashar al-Assad took office. We have to keep in mind that he inherited the position from his father when his older brother was killed in a car crash. I believe the Assad family runs the country like a family farm, and so perhaps it's not solely Bashar al-Assad's decision to attack a village or commit massacres or other brutalities. However, he is technically the president of Syria and therefore bears full responsibility for what is happening.
So how then do you break the family grip without the country descending into bloodshed? I mean, I had an analyst on the other day from the State Department Policy Planning, who's a specialist on the Middle East, Henri Bakke, who made the argument that this spat between Russia and America, between Hillary and Putin, is not particularly helpful, and you might as well try and make Russia a part of the solution as opposed to a part of the problem.
Well, Russia is already part of the problem. Russia has just sent over new attack helicopters so that the regime can shell more villages. Just 2 weeks ago, they sent a shipment, $100 million worth of military equipment to the Assad regime. Russia is very much a part of the problem and constitutes foreign intervention. With regard to ending the bloodshed is coming from the regime and the Shabiha. They're thugs who go in and massacre villagers who have on numerous occasions set fire to people while they were still alive. So the bloodshed is coming from one direction primarily.
Well, but the question would be then, if given a chance, the Syrian people would want to get rid of this regime, and they don't want a civil war, they want this to end. And the thing that's stopping it from ending is the regime and its sponsors, which are largely Russia and China.
And Iran.
And I've heard reports that Iran's actually playing a very active role in organizing the Syrian army and the intelligence people, and particularly supplying the drones that they're using ahead of these ethnic cleansing operations.
Well, in addition to supplying limited military equipment, Iran has also infused billions of dollars in cash into the Syrian economy to keep the Assad regime afloat. They have also provided some very sophisticated surveillance technology so that activists who are planning peaceful protests are targeted and tracked. And by the way, it's the same technology that was able to track Marie Colvin when she was in Homs and trying to upload her reports before the regime managed to launch a missile at the place.
Right, and I'd heard at the time when I was covering that story that it was an Iranian drone that pinpointed her. And now there's a lot more reports of this. So Iran's obviously got a lot at stake there, and so is Hezbollah next door in Lebanon. What about the reports that we hear from the deputy head of chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, who says that Syria has the world's biggest chemical weapons arsenal and might try and use them against Israel as a way to distract from their own internal problems? Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I believe that the Assad regime has been stockpiling weapons, chemical and otherwise, for the past 42 years to turn them on its own population. I mean, come on, they really haven't fired a shot at Israel in years, and instead they have trained their forces on the civilian population. So I don't think Israel needs to be concerned. I think the people of Syria need to be concerned. We've already heard reports of the use of chemical weapons in Homs, in Daraa, in some of the Damascus suburbs. So I don't believe the Israelis need to fear as much as the Syrians do.
Well, just in closing then, let's go back to the main question, which is there a way out? Is there a way to get rid of this regime, which I think clearly the Syrian people would much prefer to see the regime go than to have the country descend into wholesale bloodshed? Is there a way to do it?
Yes, we need to pressure Russia so that they stop sending shipments of weapons. We need to be more stringent in enforcing the sanctions against Syria because the economy is in a tailspin. We need to increase the presence of the UN monitors. 300 monitors for a population of 22 million is ridiculous. What we need is thousands of monitors who set up stations and who actually do monitor each city. I don't think the Assad regime will go as far as butchering United Nations monitors. We need to give that a try. We need to pressure Assad himself into either seeking exile or something. But the bottom line is the people of Syria have said very, very clearly they do not want this regime. They do not want Bashar Assad, whether as a figurehead or as a true leader. They want the regime to go.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Rafif Jujati. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Rafif Jujati, who's an English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees. A Syrian-American activist in the Washington, D.C. area, Rafif helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the U.S. is expanding a secret shadow war in Africa.
Now there's a woman on my block, just sits there, facing the hill, saying, who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
His life's a secret. Now he's hell bent.
Kodwa sizowinisa namhlanje.
Awa awa
sibona kwenzeka kanjani.
Awa awa
amantombazane ayazo.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket. Empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. He is an independent entrepreneur and human rights activist who has fought with the Congolese for 15 years in their struggle for human dignity and control of their country. And also joining us is Jacques Bahati, the policy analyst for the Africa Faith and Justice Network. He has written and spoken across the United States on the socio-political issues impacting the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maurice Carney and Jacques Bahati.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you tonight.
Well, let me begin with Maurice Carney. When your bio says that you have fought with the Congolese for 15 years in their struggle, are you talking about taking up arms?
Definitely not. Friends of the Congo Advocacy Institution based in Washington is a nonviolent, anti-military, peaceful social justice institution. So we are firmly ensconced in the principles of nonviolence and social justice change.
Well, today the Washington Post is carrying a story that the U.S. is expanding its secret shadow war in Africa. And also, of course, today the White House announced a new strategy for sub-Saharan Africa focusing on the continent's economic potential. And clearly this strategy comes as a way to perhaps blunt China's growing influence, investment, and trade in Africa. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, spoke at the Africa Growth and Opportunity Forum and talked about Africa as a land of opportunity, saying, I want all of my fellow American citizens, particularly our business community, to hear this. Africa offers the highest rate of return on foreign direct investment of any developing region in the world. Now, let me ask Jacques. My understanding is that one of the problems in the Congo is that foreign companies are basically just looting the place.
Yes, Ian, this is a very frightening situation. Let me start answering this question by saying that recently the representative Miller in the House here in Washington held a hearing to rebuke the conflict mineral law, which would address some of the abuses that goes have been going on for more than a decade, causing more unrest and perpetuating killing. And he said that implementing that law would add more burden to the American companies who are job creators. But he disregarded thousands of Congolese who died. And that is the kind of mindset that we have in leadership here in America, where it's about money and less about human rights and the lives of the people. So Indeed, it's a very, very difficult situation that is more than urgent to address the takeover of businesses or the expansion of multinationals across Africa and in Congo in particular, whereas they don't care about the lives of people and it's just about finances and profit.
So which congressman was that? Was that Gary Miller from out here in California?
Miller, he's the chairman of the subcommittee on monetary trade, international monetary and trade, I believe.
Well,
I'm not sure if he's from California.
Oh, if he's the one from California, he's been under investigation from the FBI for his own transgressions. But anyway, that's another matter. Maurice Carney, what do you know about what's happening militarily here with the U.S. expanding its secret shadow war in Africa? We know that a group of special forces have been sent into Uganda to track down Joseph Kony, who's hiding somewhere in the jungles of the Congo across the border. We also know that Rwanda has been prosecuting the Tutsi regime that drove out the Hutus, who were responsible for the genocide, have been pursuing them deeper and deeper into the eastern part of the Congo since the Rwandan genocide. So, walk us through that geopolitical scenario of what is the role of the U.S. Special Forces and how does it relate to the government of Rwanda that's pretty much an ally of the United States?
Thank you, Gary, for the question. What's important for your listening audience to understand is that since 2008, there's been an increased militarization effort on the part of the United States government on the African continent. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense at the time, in the Bush administration, 2008, established Africa Command, AFRICOM for short. And this initial aim of AFRICOM was to establish bases on the African continent. However, when President Bush traveled to Africa in 2009, he met with heads of states, and they shared with him in no uncertain terms that they did not wish to see a U.S. military presence on the African continent. Almost all the heads of states rejected the notion of establishment of bases on the African continent, except for probably Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia. So since this time, and even into the Obama administration, the United States has been seeking ways in order to expand its military footprint on the African continent. It rationalizes this expansion, or initially rationalized the expansion, by saying AFRICOM was established to help in humanitarian situations, disasters. However, when we saw the violence break out in Libya, AFRICOM was at the head in leading the bombing on Libya. So the humanitarian mask quickly fell. However, the United States has still been trying to utilize a rationale for having a presence on the continent. So they use Al-Qaeda or terrorist groups, and they say they're in pursuit of terrorist groups. The bulk of the terrorist groups that are found on the continent, they're local threats and not international threats. So that rationale is not holding up well. They got a boon out of the Kony 2012 video. Now they can justify their presence by saying they're chasing after warlords or those wanted by the International Criminal Court. So what we see, however, in spite of the different rationales that are used by the United States, the main reason for expanding U.S. military presence is to protect U.S. strategic and economic interests. And in doing that, they rely on their allies like Rwanda. So Rwanda benefits from intelligence, from training, military equipment, financial resources, in spite of Rwanda's devastating record in the Congo, where it has invaded Congo twice, supported proxy groups inside of the Congo that has contributed to the death of an estimated 6 million people. However, they continue to benefit from the largesse from the United States, whether it's in the form of intelligence, military equipment, training, and even diplomatic and political cover. And that's what we're pushing back against, the militarization of the continent and the support of strong men such as Rwanda's Paul Kagame. And that's what the progressive groups in Washington are fighting against, and that's what the American public should be aware of, that the U.S. policy on the African continent is not one that is progressive, not one that supports the people, and not one that promotes democracy, not one that promotes peace, but one that exacerbates conflict in the region.
So let me ask Jack Bahati, the people that Kagame and the Tutsi government of Rwanda have been waging war against in the Congo are the Hutu that were responsible for the genocide in the first place. So when Maurice says it's the Tutsis that are causing the trouble, these people don't sound like they're exactly pure as snow. And secondly, my understanding is that there's a tremendous United Nations presence there, although they've hardly stopped the killing, because I believe there's about 5 million people are being killed.
In the killing has not stopped. Every day we are looking at images of women and children killed by different militias, including the FDLR. The Congo has among its diversity is Tutsi people, and they deserve to live in on the Congolese territory as anybody. But after 2009, they voiced their grievances, and the government of Congo failed to follow through some of the grievances. And that has created another, discontent. Again, it's about working efficiently and governing. So they are not able to really address the grievances of the warring parties. And they are just they are about their business. It's they are feasting in Kinshasa and trading here. They're part of the network of conflict mineral instead of governing, and that is causing us problems. Rwanda has been Congo has been a playground of Rwanda for quite some time, and certainly the FDLR poses a threat to Rwanda. It's up to the Congolese government to really find out how it can build a nation that is strong and able to contain the refugees within its borders, and also deal efficiently and collaboratively with its neighbors. So we are dealing with a multifaceted issue, but the Congolese regime is mostly responsible and to blame for the ongoing, mutiny and unrest, because they are not able to sit and think and bring lasting solutions, and it's unfortunate.
So, Maurice Carney, it's just a very cynical situation we're talking about here, where it sort of serves the purpose of the Western interests, multinationals that are exploiting the mineral resources. And as Jacques mentioned earlier, a law to ban conflict minerals, coltan being important for the internet, for the kind of technology that we're using now in terms of cell phones and internet equipment, etc. So is this, and if you have a U.S. congressman who's saying, oh, this is too much of a burden on American industry, it leads you to be very suspicious that that this is a sort of divide and conquer strategy here, that it's just as long as there's low-intensity warfare and we can keep extracting the minerals, nobody's going to get their act together as a state, and it's always going to be a failed state and therefore vulnerable to exploitation.
Yeah, and really the onus, I think Jacques hinted towards it,
is for the Congolese people to organize in a way that they can protect their interests. Ultimately, that is how sustainable peace and long-lasting peace is going to come about. So the challenge for us here in the U.S. is to shine a light on the situation, but also pressure our government so that it adopts and support policies that expands the political space inside of the Congo so that the people can play a strong role in shaping the future of the country. And one of the key things that we can do is to demand that the administration cease its support of strong men in the region, whether it's Kabila inside the Congo, as they've supported Kabila since the last elections in November that Kabila appropriated, but still got the stamp of the United States government, whether it's Kagame in Rwanda, who won his last elections with 93% of the votes in his country. So here we go, the U.S. supporting another undemocratic regime, whether it's Museveni in Uganda. So we see a pattern where the United States has supported non-democratic regimes in the region, regimes that stifle the political space inside their countries, which serves as a breeding ground for conflict. So probably the biggest thing that we can do on the outside is to pressure our government so that they cease their support of strong men in the region.
Well, I'm afraid, gentlemen, we've run out of time here, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time, and I thank both of you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of Friends of the Congo, and also Jacques Bahati, policy analyst for the Africa Faith and Justice Network. I'd like to thank producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.
An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here run the free. One time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night. Just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who'll ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here on the free. One time, one night. Four small boys playing ball in the parking lot. A preacher, a teacher, and the other became a cop. A car skidded into the rain, making the last little one to say, one more light goes out in America. A young girl tosses a coin in the wishing well.